Good afternoon, everybody. Let me just introduce myself and then say a few words of introduction to this event. My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies in the University and a Fellow of this college. I'm also one of the directors of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, and today's event is organized and sponsored by three different institutions, one of which is the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is based here in the college, an independent foundation concerned with law and society, interpreting law and society in a very broad way. So pretty well everything is covered by law and society and broadly interpreted. We're also very concerned to deal with contemporary issues of importance and particular significance. And we're also concerned to convey academic research to a wider audience and readers. So that is our mission, and I'd like to welcome you here. The second institution is the one we're in, that is Woolston College, a splendid college. On a sunny day like this, you probably prefer to be walking about the gardens, but that can come later. Woolston College was founded by Isaiah Berlin, a well-known political theorist and historian of ideas in the late 1960s. It's a postgraduate college only, about 600 students and 100 fellows, and many members of the common room. It again, is very mixed, both in its disciplines and in its composition. I think on last count, we had 75 different nationalities in the college, which says something about the international world we live in. And the third institution is the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, which is my own research centre, which is part of the university, and an old institute dedicated to the study of law and society. So this is a happy coming together, happy marriage, if three people can be married, happy marriage of three institutions. So I just then introduce perhaps Alec, who you all know, I'm sure, but Alec is visiting Oxford, has been visiting Oxford for the last 6 months on a prestigious fellowship from his University of Virginia. Alec has been dividing his time between working with us here in the foundation in organizing and planning and executing events such as this one, and the rest of his time he's been concerned with research, developing ideas for doctoral studies. So Alec has been responsible for communicating with those of you around the table. So you will be all familiar with each other, at least in name, and now in person. So thank you, Alec, for your hard work and putting together this very nice, well-balanced workshop. I should just say a word about the format. We've learnt that over the years this format works well, and the key is to stimulate a dialogue around the table. So try to avoid questions and answers. That gets a bit tedious, but really rather to try to develop a critical stance, suggest ideas. And then those around the outer edges of the table, you'll have a chance to intervene from time to time. But I really want to try to get the conversation going here. Now, unfortunately, I'm not able to stay because I'm suffering from a bad cold, and rather than infect you all and interrupt by spluttering and coughing, I'll just withdraw quietly. But I'd like to wish you a very happy and successful and productive workshop, and you'll be in the very capable hands of Alec. Just before I close, I'd like to thank Phil and Amy also, who are our, Phil is our communications officer and responsible for the very splendid website, fljs.org. And for Amy Richards, whom you probably all met, who is the face not just behind the scenes, but who organises all the back room work, if you like, to these events. So thank you both, Phil and Amy. Alec, over to you.
Thank you, Dennis. I'd also like to thank Amy and Phil for your help in making this event a reality. I'd also like to thank our participants for coming all this way and agreeing to lend your expertise and time to this event. Before I turn the discussion over to the presenters, I'd just like to say a few words about the impetus behind this event. The impetus for this workshop is in no small part due to the ongoing debates over gender quotas for corporate boards in the European Union and within the United Kingdom. After Norway in 2003, gender quotas for corporate boards appeared to be gaining momentum in Europe in the early part of the decade, with Belgium and France, the Netherlands, adopting quotas all in 2011 alone. Emboldened by these domestic legislative successes, the European Commission in 2012 proposed a directive which requires publicly listed companies in the EU to reach 40% representation of the underrepresented sex on non-executive boards of directors. Although the directive had no strong enforcement mechanism, it was met with strong opposition from several EU member states, among which the United Kingdom was particularly vocal. Nevertheless, the directive was approved by the European Parliament last November and is currently awaiting approval by the Council of Ministers. Much of the early support for gender quotas for corporate boards has relied on the business case for gender diversity, or the idea that the introduction of gender quotas would lead to increased profits for corporations and greater prosperity for national economies. Perhaps the most extreme version of this logic is the oft-repeated quip that the financial crisis of 2009 might not have occurred or would have occurred very differently if the Lehman Brothers had been the Lehman Sisters. It's understandable, of course, that the business case would be popular, given its ability to turn quotas, which normally seem like a situation where you're creating winners and losers, a zero-sum game, into a big tent measure where everybody wins, corporate leadership becomes more diverse, and profits grow. Unfortunately for the proponents of the business case, the evidence in the scholarly literature thus far does not conclusively show that gender quotas lead to better firm performance. Empirical studies have thus far yielded conflicting results. That said, even if the evidence were to show that the business case lacks empirical support, this would not necessarily necessitate the abandonment of gender quotas. After all, gender equality measures, from equal pay provisions to parliamentary gender quotas, have historically been grounded in non-economic justifications like anti-subordination, anti-discrimination, and democracy. With this in mind, this workshop aims to go beyond the simple business case for gender quotas in several ways. The participants will address the various non-economic objections to gender quotas, including the argument that quotas are themselves a form of discrimination and that quotas diminish the accomplishments of women who have already become board members. In addition, the participants will address the connections between parliamentary gender quotas and corporate board quotas and the argument that gender imbalances on corporate boards undermine democratic legitimacy. Lest I risk stepping on the toes of our participants, I'll now turn over the discussion to our first presenter, Professor Jude Brown of Cambridge University, who, I'm sorry, I'm going to introduce you if you don't mind.
I thought I was going to be last, but that's fine.
Oh,
I didn't mind going first.
Is that? Do I have it backwards? I do, I'm sorry.
I don't mind. That's fine by me if you would like me to go first.
Why don't we go with the way it is on the schedule, and we'll have Professor Smith go first. So, Professor Suk, Julie Suk, who is a professor of law at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University in New York, is a leading scholar of comparative equality law. Her research has developed a transnational perspective on the theory and practice of anti-discrimination law. Professor Suk has authored over 20 articles comparing European and American approaches to a broad range of problems, including the stakes of criminal, civil, and administrative enforcement of anti-discrimination norms, the state's role in mitigating work-family conflict, the law of Holocaust denial and hate speech, and constitutional limits on race consciousness and affirmative action. She recently served as chair of the Association of American Law Schools section on comparative law and the section on employment discrimination. She is a founding executive committee member of the AAALS section on European law. She was a Jean Monnet Fellow at the European University Institute in Florence and a Law and Public Affairs Fellow at Princeton University. She has taught as a visiting professor at Harvard Law School, the University of Chicago Law School, and UCLA Law School. Before entering teaching, she clerked for Judge Harry T. Edwards on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. She obtained her A.B. summa cum laude from Harvard University in English and French Literature, a J.D. from Yale Law School, where she held a Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship, and a DPhil in Politics from Oxford University, where she held the British Marshall Scholarship. So I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you so much, Alec, and thanks so much to the Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society and to Wolfson College for hosting this really interesting workshop. I've been writing primarily about the democratic legitimacy argument for gender quotas, and the paper that I'm presenting today looks at the evolution of the EU proposal from the Commission's proposal last year to the European Parliament's amendments to it more recently in November 2013, to argue that the shift from the economic arguments towards democratic legitimacy arguments is occurring. And so I want to actually start by, and Alec started here as well, about this debate about the economic importance of gender balance. This was the predominant rhetoric that the European Commission engaged in before launching the proposed directive last year. And I think it was coming off the heels of all of these successful legislative initiatives in several European countries, starting with Norway in 2003, where it was just always said that gender equality or gender balance in leadership positions or in decision-making positions would be good for business. And as these arguments were made, there was the Lehman Sisters comments and so forth, there was always this sense that somehow it would be better for profits. There was a report by Catalyst in the United States as well that it would be better for corporate profits or better for business generally to have more women in economic decision making. And some of these economic arguments engaged in some forms of weak gender stereotyping about women being less averse to risk, and also about women having different kinds of market preferences and women being a larger part of the market. But there was some aspect of that was involved in the economic importance of gender diversity type argumentation. And one of the difficulties, I think, as Alec has already noted, with the claim that more gender balance would lead to better economic performance, is that economists actually started to study the claim, particularly with regard to whatever data they could get from Norway. And so even though the data, of course, limited because the more recent round of gender quotas legislations have taken place only 2.5 years ago, with regard to Norway, there was one study by University of Michigan economists that specifically examined the Norwegian gender parity law on the value of Norwegian firms and found that because the legal imposition of a gender quota led to the change in board membership very quickly because the Norwegian law, unlike some of the other laws that have been passed, came with a pretty hard sanction of dissolution of the company if they failed to comply within a pretty short period of time. So the companies actually did comply very quickly. Within 5 years, you see all of the companies, at least only on the boards to which the law applies. There are a lot of other boards to which the law doesn't apply where you don't see this rush up to 40%. But in any case, for the companies to whom the board applied, there was a rapid turnover in terms of who was on the boards. And these economists from the University of Michigan showed that there was actually a decrease in firm value on the corporations to which the board to which the new law applied. Although there was some question as to whether or not it was really due to the gender of the board directors as compared to just introducing an exogenous shock, that is a quick turnover in board member to come to compliance. So in that sense, it was inconclusive as to whether or not gender was good for economic performance or bad for economic performance. There were other studies that showed that the Norwegian quota law led to increased labor costs and reduced short-term profits in the affected firms. And yet another more recent study that suggested that having a critical mass of women on boards enhances the level of firm innovation. And I think to the extent that these studies are ongoing, it seems like there's a lot of contestation in the empirical data, in part because we don't have enough years of experience, but also because there's a lot of disagreement about how to measure economic performance, whether it's just in shareholder value or if it's based on firm innovation, how is that going to be measured? And so I think to the extent that it's inconclusive, it's going to remain inconclusive as long as there are social disagreements about how to measure economic performance. And so my take on this is also that we can't really strongly defend corporate board gender quotas on economic arguments alone. And if they're going to be defended, I think other forms of argumentation need to be strongly developed. The other or another major strain in the argumentation around gender quotas on corporate boards, of course, is the idea of equality in employment. And this is a particularly important argument in the European context because both the European Commission and the European Parliament have looked at equality in the EC treaty, in Treaty on the Function of the European Union, the competence of the EU to legislate corporate board gender quotas as coming from a provision that permits, through the ordinary legislative process, the adoption of binding measures to promote equality between men and women in employment. And so I think in some ways the equality argument is sort of central to the European proposal because this is the legal basis for which the legal basis on which the proposal is founded. And of course, before the proposal was even unveiled in 2012, around September, there was a very strong vocal opposition to perhaps the idea of having quotas at all, but certainly the idea of having any sanctions, regulatory sanctions or other kinds of sanctions, in a letter by 9 member states to the Commission in around September of 2012. And the UK spearheaded the opposition letter, which primarily challenged the legitimacy of EU-level action on gender quotas. It was a very succinct letter. It affirmed all the signatories' commitment to gender equality, but it noted, quote, in line with the subsidiarity principle, it is first and foremost up to the member states to find their own national approaches to achieving this goal. And there were countries, including the Netherlands, which had already passed its own quotas legislation, that also signed the letter, affirming this idea that that Europe maybe didn't have competence, or even if it did, shouldn't encroach upon the member states in imposing a Europe-wide corporate board gender quota. And the letter wasn't signed by any German officials, but Germany, too, has opposed EU-level action. And German corporate law scholars have taken the view that the EU lacks competence to legislate gender quotas on corporate boards, because their reading of Article 157 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union is that it really just applies to employment. And particularly, it is within Article 157, which primarily substantively goes to equal pay. But Section 3 says shall adopt measures to ensure the application of the principle of equal opportunities and equal treatment of men and women in matters of employment and occupation, including the principle of equal pay for equal work or work of equal value. So many German scholars have taken the position that that this treaty provision would only authorize legislative action to promote equality in employment, and there's a question as to whether or not board directors are covered under a provision that really addresses employment. And this is something that the European Commission and Parliament has been working hard to sort of define the corporate board directors as employees because they do get remuneration for serving in these positions. But in any case, the fact that this treaty provision, the idea of promoting equality in employment and equal pay for equal work, that this is the basis for gender quotas, I think somewhat explains why there's there's such an emphasis on European arguments as well, on economic arguments as well. To the extent that the EU's competence to legislate equality of men and women in employment derives from legitimate authority originally within the European Economic Community to create a single European market, a gender equality measure that promises to promote the EU's economic growth seems to fall more easily, perhaps, within this competence than something that's just concerned with gender equality in economic affairs more broadly. And certainly, Viviane Reding at the Commission has sort of suggested that Article 157, Section 3 of the TFEU encompasses a broader competence to legislate generally on gender equality and economic matters. But one of the difficulties also of emphasizing this treaty provision so much, or the norm of equal treatment in European Union law in the context of employment, one difficulty that arises in hooking gender quotas onto these legal provisions is that it then implicates the application of the Court of Justice's case law on positive action, which then constrains the extent to which quotas can be used. Specifically, there is case law, which I want to get into in a moment, which I think explains why when the Commission introduced its proposal in the fall of 2012, the enforcement mechanisms looked the way they did. Alec mentioned that there were actually no clear enforcement mechanisms, that is, that you didn't have sanctions of the sort that you see in the national legislations, like no threat of corporate dissolution, no threat of just invalidating the election of any particular director. But what you did see in that proposal, and it remains in the proposal adopted, although in somewhat revised form, in the proposal adopted by the Parliament, what you did see is Article 4.1 of the proposed directive, which basically the only thing that's really, that the member states really have to do is to ensure, quote, ensure that listed companies in whose boards members of the underrepresented sex hold less than 40% of the non-executive director positions make the appointments to those positions on the basis of a comparative analysis of the qualifications of each candidate by applying pre-established, clear, neutrally formulated, and unambiguous criteria in order to attain the said percentage at the latest by the 1st of January 2020 or the latest by 1st of January 2018 in case of listed companies which are public undertakings. So that's the substantive provision, but the enforcement mechanism, no sanctions or dissolution or anything like that, the only substantive enforcement that the proposed directive requires is, quote, in order to attain the objective laid down in paragraph one, which is what I just read, member states shall ensure that in the selection of non-executive directors, priority shall be given to the candidate of the underrepresented sex if that candidate is equally qualified as a candidate of the other sex in terms of suitability, competence, and professional performance, unless an objective assessment taking account of all criteria specific to the individual candidates tilts the balance in favor of the candidate of the other sex. Clear if you think about what this really means. So it requires a kind of anti-discrimination enforcement mechanism. Someone who is not selected, who's a member of the underrepresented sex, can bring a lawsuit against a company that hasn't met the 40% quota. But the way that the lawsuit would go is something like this. That is, so that the directive, the commission's version of the directive, would require companies to favor a female candidate as a means of achieving the 40% quota, but only under circumstances where the female candidate is equally qualified already as the male candidate. If the qualifications are unequal, this provision that gives priority to the female is totally inapplicable. No priority is to be given. And of course, this raises a huge question about what makes any board candidate equally qualified to any other board candidate. And you could imagine a situation, so just a hypothetical situation, if you consider the possibility of a male candidate with, say, 10 years of experience serving on the boards of other corporations, so we might say that's a qualification for serving on the board of another corporation, and you could compare that with a female candidate with less experience, say 5 years, and you might even say that they're both actually minimally qualified or well qualified to serve on the board of company X. But I don't think anyone would say that they are equally qualified because the additional years of experience would make the person with 10 years experience, if that person happens to be male, more qualified. And under the Commission's version of the directive, if you have two minimally qualified people, but one is more qualified than the other, you don't give automatic priority, or you don't give any priority to the female candidate or the underrepresented candidate, because you can only do that under circumstances where you have already equal qualifications. And then furthermore, even if you did have two candidates that you could say somehow were equally qualified, so let's, if you imagine a male and female candidate with 10 years experience and pretty similar resumes, even in under those circumstances, the Commission's version of the directive says that it's possible for the male candidate or the overrepresented sex candidate to be selected anyway if there are special circumstances that tilt the balance in favor of the overrepresented sex candidate. And what that essentially means is that you're imagining an enforcement mechanism wherein the unsuccessful candidate brings this kind of lawsuit, they'd have to show equal qualifications to assert any claim to priority under a quota, and even that could be defeated by some special showing by the company, or perhaps by the male candidate, but more likely by the company, that there were special circumstances that tilted the balance in favor of the male candidate. And so if you imagine on the ground how this kind of enforcement mechanism works, it basically totally gets rid of the mandatoriness of having any kind of quota. But it's not a completely crazy way of setting it up in light of the existing case law by the European Court of Justice on positive action. Specifically, that you had a case called Kalonki, which interpreting the Equal Treatment Directive, there was a challenge to an employment policy giving preference to female candidates for jobs in which women were represented. The European Court of Justice refers to this as a quota system and says that even though both the treaty provision and the Equal Treatment Directive that are being invoked, even though there's an exception for positive action, the Court of Justice basically says that the exception has to be construed narrowly, and so you can't give automatic priority to female candidates. And so then the question remains is if it's not going to be automatic priority, what kind of priority can be given at all, consistent with the positive action provisions of both the treaty and the Equal Treatment Directive. And then a few years later, in this case called Marshall, the European Court of Justice upholds a similar policy. That is, they don't invalidate something that pretty much looks like a quota system for women. But they say that as long as women are not giving automatic priority, and there's this possibility of a male showing that there are circumstances, or a company showing that there are special circumstances that tilt the balance in favor of the male candidate, and that the priority to women is only used as a tiebreaker, meaning you're dealing with people of equal qualifications, then the Marshall case suggests that a priority to female candidates adopted under such circumstances could be consistent with the equality guarantees of the Equal Treatment Directive. And then finally, in 2000, the European Court of Justice also upholds another system. It's kind of a positive action system that's designed to increase the proportion of women in sectors in which women are underrepresented. And the court notes that because female candidates are less likely to be promoted because of prejudices and stereotypes concerning the role and capacities of women in working life, so that the mere fact that a male candidate and a female candidate are equally qualified does not mean they have the same chances. It upholds or says that it's the Equal Treatment Directive is consistent with a national rule whose objective is to eliminate the underrepresentation of women for occupations in which underrepresented. And so it makes it possible to do that as long as there's no preference for female candidates whose qualifications are significantly or objectively inferior to those of a male candidate. So in light of this case law that is trying to construe the positive action provision pretty narrowly, but in more recent iterations perhaps opening up, there is this question about if there is competence to legislate, it has to be done consistent with this case law. And so there's a certain focusing on the equality or equality in employment argument for corporate board gender quotas kind of implicates this whole baggage of positive action difficulties. But at the same time also, without implicating this baggage, the ability of the European Union to have a strong directive with sanctions would also come into question as a question of competence. And I think these are some of the things that are driving the confusion between economic arguments, equality arguments. And then what I'll focus on now, which I think are which I call the democratic legitimacy arguments. So if you think now about the evolution of the proposal, it was released by the Commission in November 2012, and Parliament voted on it in November 2013 with some notable amendments that I want to focus on here. One thing to think about that is in terms of the evolution of the proposal, there was certainly a lot of discussion, I think, in the Parliament, and a document that was released about gender quotas in electoral systems within the European Union, European Economic Area countries. And it was a report that was updated in June 2013. There was a previous report written by Drudy Dalarup from Sweden about gender quotas in elected office. And even though the report that was issued by the European Parliament didn't really make mention of corporate board gender quotas, I think floating in the discussion to some degree is the existence of many European electoral systems in which there are quotas for women. So even though the link hasn't been explicitly drawn, I do think that there's always been this kind of parallelism between corporate board gender quotas and political or electoral gender quotas, as if they're sort of part of the same thing, even though nobody has really talked explicitly about what the relationship between the two are, and certainly to the extent that the corporate board gender quotas debates have focused on the economic arguments, it sort of suggests maybe the corporate board gender quotas are a separate thing. But I do think that in the European Parliament's amendments to the Commission's proposal, this link between gender equality in the public sphere or in political institutions and gender equality in economic institutions has become much more explicit. And it's the arguments have coalesced around how to legitimize governance in the European Union. Because as I read the European Parliament's amendments to the Commission's proposal, I think there are four major changes that sort of focus on democratic legitimacy. The first is that they've added a bunch of recitals that weren't in the Commission's proposal that basically just affirm the importance of gender equality in decision-making in EU institutions in particular. Secondly, there are also, very interestingly, and one might wonder what they have to do with corporate boards, but interestingly, there's a bunch of recitals, just declarations, in the Parliament's version of the legislation, encouraging the member states to promote work-family balance through various policy suggestions. Third, there are actual revisions to the provision that I just talked about in the Commission's proposal about the enforcement provisions and what kinds of plaintiffs could bring the lawsuits and what they would need to show in order to enforce the quotas provision. And then finally, very interestingly, there's a deletion of in the Commission's proposal. There was an exemption for companies in which the underrepresented sex make up less than 10% of the workforce in that company, and they've just gotten rid of that. And I think that says something about how they're conceptualizing the justification for these quotas. So I want to start with the recitals on European Union institutions, because you see this recital at the very beginning that's quite interesting. The Union institutions, quote, the Union institutions, bodies, offices, and agencies, and the European Central Bank should lead by example as regards gender equality in decision-making, inter alia, by setting objectives for a gender-balanced representation at all levels. And there's also explicitly a mention of a democratic deficit in the European Union. There's an amended recital that reads, despite the existing union legislation aimed at preventing and combating sex discrimination, the Council recommendations aim specifically at increasing the presence of women in economic decision-making and union-level actions encouraging self-regulation, women continue to be strongly underrepresented in the highest decision-making bodies of companies throughout the union. In the private sector, and especially in listed companies, this gender imbalance is particularly significant and acute. And while certain union institutions and agencies, such as the European Central Bank, also display a deeply problematic gender imbalance, the Commission's key indicator of gender representation on corporate boards shows that the proportion of women involved in top-level business decision-making remains very low. In January 2012, women occupied on average just 13.7% of board seats in the largest publicly listed companies in member states. Among non-executive directors, only 15% were women, which is a clear indication of a democratic deficit and of unfair and discriminatory representation of women in violation of union principles of equal opportunities and equal treatment of both sexes in the fields of employment and occupation. And so I think it's quite interesting that they point specifically to the underrepresentation of women, not just in corporate boards, but also in the European Central Bank as being deeply problematic, and then embraces this language of democratic deficit, which has been around as the European Union has reorganized its institutions to respond to this notion of lack of democratic legitimacy for several decades. And so now this proposition that, well, if you don't have enough women, 15% women in corporations and underrepresentation of women in central bank is an indication of democratic deficit, we can think about what that means when we're talking about these private sector organizations. And sometimes the argument, it's not perfect, that is, it lapses into, well, it means you're not using the entire talent pool, and that's bad for companies, bad for economic performance. So I think there is a way in which the economic performance arguments come into this discourse of democratic legitimacy. The other thing that I think has been very interesting is all of the recitals that focus on work-family balance. That is, you have an amendment that says that member states should put in place provisions whereby men and women can combine work and family life, in particular flexible arrangements and support for those with care responsibilities. There's another recital, or part of the same amendment, but a slightly separate recital. It says the fact that women are typically responsible for the large majority of family and household chores may hinder their advancement to top professional positions. Attention should be paid to tackling gender stereotyping, inflexible and outdated employment policies, inadequate parental leave provisions. There's another amendment that explicitly says that encourages policy mechanisms, including flexible work schedules and encouraging family-friendly workplaces by providing access to daycare. So these recitals, that is, this is still our directive on corporate boards, on gender balance on corporate boards. And so one might ask, why are they talking about gender balance? Engaging men in more household chores in a directive that's about more women on corporate boards of directors. I think largely it's because there's a way in which the broader gender agenda, not just corporate boards, not just the economic performance type arguments, but the broader gender agenda of having gender equality in employment, and gender equality in private life is associated with, has become a kind of legitimating discourse for the European Union. And so there's a way in which that is being embraced as a way of trying to legitimize these powerful institutions, both in the economic and in the public realm. You'll see also that the European Parliament tries to fix the enforcement problem that I was pointing to earlier in the Commission's proposal, or at least to make it a little bit, have a little bit more teeth. So specifically, instead of just having a requirement that the companies use a comparative analysis of the qualifications of each candidate to try to get to the 40% by these particular dates, the Parliament's amendments actually requires all these transparency rules and requires trying to get gender balance at every single stage of the recruitment process. So the substantive provision now reads they have to adjust their recruitment, including vacancy announcements, calling for applications, pre-selection, selection, and appointment procedures in such a way that they effectively contribute to the attainment of the said percentage. It requires a short list of the most qualified candidates from a gender balanced selection pool. With these now, if requiring a gender balance recruitment pool at every stage, the enforcement provision also has been modified so that it's not just the people who were not selected for board positions, but everybody who considers themselves wronged by the company's failure to comply with these procedural and recruitment guarantees, provisions that could bring a suit. And then when they bring a suit under the Parliament's version, they have to simply prove that all of these new provisions, gender balance, recruitment pool, advertising, transparency, all of those things, they have to show that those things were not complied with instead of just engaging in this equal qualifications, tilting the balance, and then the company being able to say, no, there was a tilting of the balance in favor of the male candidate. So it enlarges the potential pool of enforcers, and it also makes different what the plaintiff enforcing the quota would have to show in order to find the company liable. So it gives the sanctions a little bit more teeth. As I mentioned earlier, we have that provision getting rid of the exemption for the companies that have very few of one sex. That is, all the companies now have to comply with it. And it goes to show then that the quota is not just about representing the people in a particular workplace. The quota is really about what you could do to make each institution, not just as an economic actor, but possibly also as a political actor, more legitimate. And to just be a little bit more explicit about why it's so important for corporate boards to attain this level of political legitimacy, the discourse of the democratic deficit, I think, focuses a lot on, and at least at the European level, I don't want to spend too much time getting into the debates, but I think so much of the evolution of the debate about the democratic deficit of the EU has focused on the lack of representativeness of the major institutions of the EU, the European Parliament, the Council, the Commission. Specifically, I think the Commission has been subject to the most serious criticisms from a democratic legitimacy standpoint because it still really is the only EU institution that can initiate and draft legislation, which then goes to the Parliament, and citizens are just not directly or indirectly represented as they are in the Parliament or in the Council. And I think one of the things where it's not just a bunch of people in Brussels legislating from Brussels is that there is, at least in the kinds of policies that we're concerned about with regard to gender and women, all of these social policies, the Commission is required to consult with labor and management on the future of on the future direction of union action. So you have Article 152 on the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union that specifically says the union recognizes and promotes the role of the social partners at its level, taking into account the diversity of national systems. It shall facilitate dialogue between the social partners, respecting their autonomy. To this end, the European Commission actually maintains a list of social partner organizations that they view as requiring consultation under Article 154 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. The general cross-industry organizations at the top of the list are Business Europe, the European Center of Employers and Enterprises providing public services, the European Trade Union Confederation. And on the one level, I mean, I think the focus has been on the corporations or the employers rather than the unions, in part, which is not to say that gender representation on unions is perfect, but I think the trade unions have had women's committees and other mechanisms to improve gender representation since the 1970s. But none of the cross-sectoral employers' federations have been great or have had really specific programs dealing with gender representation issues. So at one level, I think the idea that corporations have to have gender balance boards ties directly into the increasingly recognized power of corporations, both as individual lobbyers as well as those acting collectively through social partner organizations, that they influence policy by lobbying the Commission. They influence policy by lobbying the Council as well. And to the extent that much of supranational law is made in this way, law and policy is made in this way, I think there is a call for legitimizing the power by making it more representative. This is not to say that gender balance is the only thing that will legitimize it, but I think it's certainly considered a step in light of institutions that are not seen as being directly accountable to the people. And I'll give you an example, finally, of this, which I think drives the point home. So in recent memory, there were proposals to amend the maternity leave directive, or it was a directive on pregnant workers. And the commission started talking about it in around 2008, 2009, and proposed a directive that would have extended maternity leave, including the provisions in the existing pregnant workers directive, providing for paid maternity leave for at least 6 weeks following following the birth of a child. And the commission's proposal, I think, required all the member states to have at least 18 weeks of maternity leave. And Parliament then extended it from 18 to 20 weeks and also added some provisions on paternity leave. And there's great variety in terms of the types of paternity leave available in most of the member states. But the council rejected it. And the council rejected it in part because there was a lot of lobbying by Business Europe specifically against these provisions of making maternity leave longer and making a portion of it, a good chunk of it, paid. And there's still no, it's been in legislative limbo since 2010, although there has been a framework agreement also brokered by the social partner organizations on parental leave. And that has been important. And that too, the social partner organizations, Business Europe, the European Trade Union Confederation, they've obviously played a very important role in coming up with the framework agreement, which then has governed at least on some of these issues. But it's just without a question, particularly if you try to link back now this debate, the corporate board gender quotas debate, why are they talking so much about work-family issues? It's in part because in very recent memory, a lot of this lobbying has put the paternity leave directive in legislative limbo. And there are other examples. And certainly very recently now, you have the Business Task Force report in the UK calling for general deregulation of the EU, but one of the specific things that the Business Task Force report issued in October 2013 is calling for is the withdrawal of the Pregnant Workers Directive. And I think that's kind of interesting as well. It's obvious that a lot of these corporations, either as individual lobbyists or through social partner organizations, play a very important and perhaps invisible role in shaping European policy, and the need to then apply certain principles of representation, particularly gender representation, especially when social policy has such important gender effects. I think that this is a very important, but not necessarily explicitly articulated dimension of why gender balance on corporate boards is thought to be important. So I think I'm going to end there. And